statutes and determine if this is the policy that we want to pursue. And if this is the policy we want to pursue, if we do want consumers protected, then we should probably require that any agreement that someone drafts has this notice to consumers, or maybe we should repeal the law.
Now, may I ask at this point?
Yes.
I gather that when you deliver the list to the air finders, you put the notice about the unenforceability of any contracts. But when you send the materials, the bank book or the stock, to the air, do you also notify them that any contract is unenforceable?
They probably don't. Yeah.
Now, Mr. Chairman, we do not. Most of the air search firms, what they do is they contact the owner or the air, and they get a power of attorney to act in their behalf. And so they become the owner for the purpose of collecting.
So the owner is left covered in the dark and covered with manure.
So. Mr. Chair, I think I agree with my conservative colleague in my right here.
I thought you would see the
that apparently 98.418 and this secrecy bill are designed to prevent rightful owners from reclaiming their property. Because if it's intended to put the searchers out of business, which this, if enforced, or if the consumers were aware of it, there would be no incentive for a searcher to contact the owners. And since the efforts of the Lands Division are of no avail, then they end up with all the money. The poor consumer who's got a couple $100,000 on deposit that his great uncle left is out of luck. So I agree with Senator Hendrickson that we should certainly repeal 98.418, and that if we want to put any confidentiality in the bill, I would assume that you publish once, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman,
then
yes.
If you don't get a response within 30 days after that publication, you're probably not going to get one, and your records could substantiate that possibly, that if we make any confidentiality, it should be only for a 30-day period, so that the poor owner out there has a much better chance of getting his money. It's axiomatic in the collection business that if you don't get after an account within 2 or 3 months, you might as well write it off. And if any delay in searching for the heirs or the owner who hasn't responded to the ad is that much less effective. So I think the searchers are probably providing a desirable service. I'd much rather get 90% or even 50% of what's due me than nothing at all. As much as I like the state of Oregon, would like to see them get it. I don't think that's just. So that would be my, if we put any confidentiality in the law, let's make it 30 days. And I would be in favor of eliminating 98.418 altogether.
If I might comment, Mr. Chairman, the reason that we are asking for this confidentiality is because we don't have possession of the money, and we run into a lot of embarrassment if an air searcher contacts an owner and the next day he gets our notice and he's already signed up to pay 40% of what he found.
But Mr. Chairman, and is that your notice happen? Taking 30 days to reach you?
Sometimes it does. We publish in the newspaper, Mr. Chairman, Senator Simmons, and maybe it's a friend that recognized the name and he writes a letter to somebody. We've had many instances where as much as 2 months after the notice went in the paper, we get calls from the owner. What we're asking for in this legislation is merely to delay that searching company doing active searching until after we physically get the property, where we know that he can't go back to the holder and get everything that he was entitled to receive. That's what we're asking for, Mr.
Chair. You say some have run possibly as long as 60 days.
Yes.
Well, then wouldn't 60 days be better than 9 months for the searcher to start?
It would, what we would have to do, Mr.
Better
Chairman,
better for the consumer, not for you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Mr. So, would be 60 days after we publish notice.
And in your published notice,
which would be then a period of about 5 months, is what I'm trying to say, that it really isn't 60, because we get notified in November. During November and December, we're putting our records together in order to get a computer printout badge at the end of January that we put in the paper sometime in the end of February.
This is the middle of March, and you're just publishing it.
We're published. We got the things ready. We're a little bit behind schedule this cycle, but our schedule is called for at the end of February that we should put a notice in the paper.
Mr. Henderson.
I just wanted to know, on that figure you gave of the, you said $370,000 of property was returned. What percentage of that was found by these entrepreneur types, and what percentage was found by the department?
I don't know, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hendricks, that I can give you exact percentage. There was a significant amount of that was found by the agency through our publication and through our notice. I would say that the percentage was better than 50% found by the agency.
In this?
In this last year.
And then would this confidentiality increase that percentage?
I don't know that it would increase it, Mr. Chairman. It eliminates the problem that we have where an air searcher getting the name and address and the amount off these records when they're reported and can beat us in the sense of timing and sign somebody up for a 20% or 30% fee when the owner doesn't realize what he's being told because he don't know yet. And next day is contacted by a relative or by us, and he could have gone to the holder and got the same money with no cost. That's where our concern is.
In your ad, do you make any reference to the fact that these contracts are unenforceable?
It is if the department.
In the ad, no. No, we do not.
But would that be a constructive procedure?
That if we included in the ad that any air search firm that contacts the owner,
that the contract is unenforceable.
I could respond this way, Mr. Chairman. If the owner would read that in the paper, he would know his name was in there and have made contact with us. I don't know that it would do anything for him.
Well,
see?
Or the relative that wrote him the letter,
Chairman,
and his other example.
What would be the longest time period? Would 6 months be perhaps a more reasonable window to allow you to protect the...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hamby, what we're looking for is some
period of time
that would allow us to receive the report from the holder, get the information into the computer systems, get the advertising out, get it on the street, and allow a sufficient time for the public, friends, owners, relatives to have seen the notices and attempted to try to get in contact with us or the holder.
6 months then would not.
6 months would not be unreasonable. We just merely selected the date of payment because that's the day in which we have possession of it, and the holder doesn't have possession any longer.
Mr. Chair, I think maybe we ought to write legislation that speeds up their process. I can't imagine that it takes them from November to April or March to get a notice in the paper. That's November, December, January, February, March. That's 5 months.
Limited budget.
That number one, Mr. Chairman, it's limited budget. We do this account with 1.5 staff people. And we have not asked to increase it yet. We're under the gun. We're very shorthanded. This year so far, the volume of accounts is maintaining a high rate. We're already on the accounts nearly $2 million this year again. The workload, and the thing is that we start getting reports in November. Holders report in November, December, and January. And that's the months that we batch in and try to get the publication out in the month of February. And we're this month this year behind schedule. There's no question. We're about 3 weeks behind in getting it in the paper. But that was our fault because we don't have the staff to put it all in and get it out.
Chair, maybe we could give them a slight commission instead of the searcher and give them enough money to hire somebody to run the computer. The way it looks is that the land board is not very anxious to get the money back to the owner. And if it were a profit-making business that's always nefarious and trying to aggrandize their own money, net worth, then I would believe it. But for a state agency to take that attitude just is, you know, if it were one of Mr. Bronner's banks that's trying to take advantage of the public that way, then, gosh, we'd all believe it. But for the state of Oregon to be one of the chief people, it boggles my mind. I'm amazed.
I think that considering the constraints that that small division within the land board's office has, and I've heard their budget last year, and having heard Mr. Brent come before us for this committee 2 years ago, I feel quite confident that at least the intentions are here to protect the consumer, if not the scheme of the law. So I'm sure if this is fine-tuned, our apprehensions and your goals could maybe be achieved. Senator Hendrickson.
The interest goes into the common school fund, so you don't get any. Is that constitutional or is that statutory?
It's
Mr. Chairman, the interest does not go into the common school fund. The interest is distributed to the public schools. Right now, in the abandoned property account, we have something like $11 million. On today's interest rate, we're turning over to the schools for their use as benefit to the public schools, roughly $1 million a year, earned continually on that $11 million fund.
So we get about $20 million on trees and about $1 million on old briefcases.
Okay, but what the question I was asking, Mr. Chair, is to finance this service.
Yes.
Is that I assume their budget comes from the general fund. They're not allowed. Are you allowed to drive a service charge on this money?
Mr. Chairman, if I might. We are not general funded. We are fully paid from our own functions. In other words, our rents, royalties, and incomes that we generate as the land board pays our entire bill. We use no general fund monies. We cannot, by constitution, assess a deduction for the services we provide from interest. The Constitution says that all interest on the earnings of the Common School Fund must be distributed. So we survive in this program off the surplus monies that we earn on all other aggregate programs that we administer in the agency. In other words, the agency as a total earns X dollars from all of its sources of activities, and part of that is paid for all of the functions that we perform. Now, this account does contribute to that total, because as your senior counsel stated in his opening remarks, after an account stays with the land board for 25 years, then it becomes a permanent part of the school fund. So the $3 million that we earned this year or received this year, 25 years from now, if that is not paid out, it will be permanently the common school funds. So each year there is a portion of what was collected 25 years ago in each year that comes into the fund itself. And that, of course, can be used to pay our current expenses and is.
Mr. Chair, I like the idea of the $1 million going to the school fund in the interest, but when it comes out of the mouths of widows and orphans who would otherwise have this money that's being held, it doesn't seem to be a very fair trade-off. I'd rather give them a small percentage if that would help them with their budget to distribute this more properly.
The percentage problem is the constitutional problem.
Well, the percentage is...
The principal reverts to the state at 25 years.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think Senator Simmons is referring to a percentage of the interest. He's talking about a percentage of the principal that's turned over to us.
Before it vests.
Before it vests in the common school fund, or at the time we receive it. In other words, we have discussed this with the land board for a number of years. How do we set a percent of an account? I feel very uncomfortable to say, well, we'll charge 10%. 10% of a $10 account, 10% of a $50,000 account. It is very difficult to set fees based on percents. And the land board has not adopted that kind of an assessment or recommended it because of that problem of saying, you know, because it takes us maybe no more effort to find a $50,000 account than it takes to find a $500 account.
If you would then cost account your actual function, it may be $27.30 for each notice, and plus another $20 to process it, or so it may maybe levy that amount.
Yes.
Against the principal.
Yes,
Mr. Chair, it could be a 1% with a minimum of $10 or whatever. I would assume that you buy a full page ad in the paper and get 5,000 names on it or something like that. So that cost per name very expensive.
We do assess a fee, a limited fee, to cover the advertising, Senator. Mm-hmm. But what we do not is cover enough fees in handling this volume of accounts to pay a staff member in a year's time, for example.
It wouldn't take a staff member a year to type up 5,000 names.
No, but I mean there's an ongoing function all the time. We receive inquiries, phone calls, claims. Some of these claims take as many as 10 letters going back and forth to permanently identify that owner is the owner. And in many cases, the owner claims he's the owner, and we know he's the owner, but because of the way that he filed his insurance account in 20 years ago and left beneficiaries that are now deceased, he's no longer the owner because it went into his will and went someplace else. Okay. And we find these kind of problems that take hours and hours worth of work.
Well, Mr. Brenner, maybe we can you can propose some amendments to one of the other later two bills which deal directly with abandoned property and not with the Freedom of Information Law.
Right.
Because and then the question that we would have would be whether or not subsection L in Senate Bill 229 could be amended to reflect a shorter period. And I know that you've gauged that based upon the time of delivery.
Delivery, yes.
I'm not sure if that's possible. But
and Mr. Chairman, I have no objection with the recommendation that Senator Hendricks stated relative to that two-year provision. It's not a big thing because I don't think it's enforceable one way or the other. Holding the air searchers back from making a search and saying they can't recover their fees.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess my feeling is if it's a good policy, then we should make it enforceable by requiring the contracts to have it right on there so that people are aware of their rights and will enforce it. If it's not a good policy, then I think we should get rid of it. I think it's not a good, I don't think it's legally good to put things on the books, giving people rights when they're not going to be able to enforce them.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Andrew, I very well agree with you.
Mr. Thank Chairman, before we leave this, if I would like to make one more brief point about the interaction between 98-418, the 24-month period, and the proposed bill, and that is that if the committee decides to preserve the policy that is now in 98-418, I think that legally there's an argument to be made that a contract that the air searcher might enter into with a claimant during that interim period after the division receives notice but before the property is delivered could be enforceable. And so with this confidentiality proposal, we'd eliminate that problem. If you desire to preserve that policy, maybe we'll have to look at that if you don't also want to approve the bill that's before you.
The point you're making is that the unenforceability runs from the date of the delivery.
Yes.
And you're talking in terms of contracts prior to that date, which technically then would be enforceable.
Yes, that argument is certainly available.
By blanketing that period with confidentiality, you're not going to have that problem.
Yes.
But we get back to the basic policy notion as to whether they should be enforceable or not, because we're not honoring the policy by putting it on the contract. If the policy has any value at all, we should do that, and if it does not have value, then we should abandon the policy. Thank you. Well, that would bring us, if it appears to be the appropriate thing to do, is move on to Senate Bill 230. Brad, you can hit that one more time for us.
Okay, 230 is a bill, again, dealing with abandoned property. And the basic purpose for the bill as written would be to allow business associations that held or owned intangible ownership interests ownership interests to transfer those ownership interests to the state division of lands if they were considered abandoned. It establishes a procedure by the issuance of a duplicate certificate for those intangible ownership interests, and I believe they're talking about something in the nature of stock. And finally, the third thing the bill does is to remove the provision that requires this state to pay for the actions of other states that other states bring in this state to find abandoned property, and establishes alternative provisions for doing that. There are some comments that I have on the bill, basically questions. My questions are, what is an intangible ownership interest? The term is not defined in the bill, and it's not defined anywhere in statute. It's just used one other place in the entire ORS.
At that point, maybe we can ask our Deputy Attorney General if she would comment on
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
But in case law, in common law, there's intangible interests, I think, are defined, I would assume.
And that's how I would respond, Mr. Chairman, that intangible ownership interest in a business association does have its own definition that has evolved in case law, and we would rely on that. And in one sense, there's another policy decision to make whether you want to try to limit and define what is a very difficult term to put into a brief statutory definition.
Like reasonable man or due care.
They're putting it in context. If I might add, they are putting it in a different context than it appears traditionally in case law.
Mr. Chair, excuse me.
In terms of abandoned property as cheating to the state, as I don't believe that that's an area that you find an intangible property interest defined regularly in case law.
It's a different context, but it's the same interest.
That's how I'd respond, Mr. Chairman, that it is the context of abandoned property law, but the interest that we're talking about is the same type of interest that's discussed in other areas of the law. And if I were arguing the case, I'd make a very strong argument that those definitions would apply.
Now, we normally would not think of an easement as an intangible ownership interest, would we?
No, Mr. Chairman, I would say that's a real property interest and would not fall within an intangible ownership interest. I'd also point out, I believe you have before you some proposed amendments from the division, where we recognize that the wording in the printed bill is vague, and I appreciate Council Mr. Swank bringing that to our attention today, and so we've tried to limit it a little bit or make more clear what the intent of the bill is.
Now, does your proposed amendments run to Mr. Swank's first comment?
Is that a fair statement?
No.
Okay. Then let's maybe discuss those proposed amendments after we discuss the corporate comment. Let's, for the moment anyway, the concern is the definition, and counsel says her thought was to rely upon the common law definition, even in this unusual context. I'm not sure if that answers it, but that's that. Let's move on to the second point, if you could, Brad.
Okay. My second point is basically that, as amended by the bill, ORS 98322 provides that intangible ownership interests are presumed abandoned 5 years after the date prescribed for payment or delivery. And in fact, my question is, what is the date of payment or delivery of an intangible property? Intangible ownership interest, normally there is some certificate delivered or paid, as opposed to the interest itself being paid. And in the list that's established in the amendment, it speaks to both stocks and other certificates of ownership, and then adds to that list intangible ownership interests. My next comment is... Okay.
Let's stick there. Could you respond to that? I have a feeling maybe the banks are sending the list of names, and that doesn't quite qualify as a payment or delivery.
I sort of have a question on the same line. The way I read this is that the corporation itself is issuing the duplicate because they have been issuing dividends, or they can't find someone to issue a dividend. So they're, but what I was saying is you could have, say, the same person that's disappeared has left a stock certificate in a safety deposit box at a bank. And you could find yourself with the corporation issuing a duplicate certificate and maybe the bank then turning over at some other time the original stock certificate. And I was just wondering if, or some other party that might have be holding it for them. And I was just wondering how you reconcile those.
Mr. Chairman, that could very well happen, that just as Senator was saying, that we could have a stock certificate issued by a company, a corporation, having delivered it to a customer, he putting it in a safety deposit box, and then forgot the safety deposit box. We will wind up then with the original certificate as an abandoned or unclaimed safety contents of a safety deposit box, because the statute in another section says that if an owner fails to pay the rent on a safety deposit box 5 years from that date, the bank would turn the contents over to the Division of State Lands, which would include the original certificate. Now we've got two certificates.
The same number.
Well, I'm just afraid about the timing, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose then you just cancel the original at the time
issued
a duplicate.
That's right. That's what would happen, because we wouldn't have two. In other words, even if we didn't recognize it and we tried to sell the original, they would tell us we've issued a duplicate and therefore we can't sell the original. And then we would know that we had a duplicate. And that happens today. People are going to receive stock certificates today, and you're going to forget about it, but you know you have it. So you write to the company, and you make out a sworn statement of lost instrument, and you can do that, and they will issue a duplicate. Maybe that original will turn up.
Directing your attention, Mr. Brenner, to the issue raised by Mr. Swank, what is the date of payment or delivery?
Okay. The
how do we resolve that?
Okay.
Because we have a five-year period here.
The date of payment is referred to as the date that, like a salary check that is due and payable on the first of a month, that's the date of payment. Whether it's in effect delivered or not, the date of payment is the first of the month. A stock certificate is the date the stock certificate is issued, and that's the date the 5 years begins running on. It's the date that it's issued, deliverable, or payable. So if a check is payable on the first of the month, is undelivered, unaccepted, uncashed, it runs from 5 years from that date. a stock certificate that's issued is dated, and the 5 years runs from that date.
Do you know of any intangible ownership interest that, where you could not establish a definite date?
The only intangible, no, all of them. I can define a date for any intangible interest, whether it's a stock certificate, a cashier's check, a money order, a payroll check, a gift certificate. We can go down the list of all of them, and there is a fixed date that it was issued, and that's the date it runs from.
Brad, does that seem to satisfy you?
I don't have to vote. I still have some questions about them. Yes.
Fine. We're not. I'm just trying to see how much exposure we have here.
Senator, I have a little question about the statement that the date of the stock certificate being the date that it's issued. But assuming I have a stock certificate that I've bought and paid for and received, and for 5 years I don't have any